The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
What I have in mind tonight is to give an introductory talk for a series of talks that I have planned for the next weeks when I'm here on Mondays. So not next Monday, but Mondays after that, on emotions. And I thought I would give some introductory words about emotions today, and then in the next upcoming Mondays, give a series of talks on individual emotions. So, you know, a talk on anger and fear, joy. So whatever emotion seems to be up for me that day. Or that week. And then we'll see how long the series goes. I'm aware that there's a long list of emotions. So we could be busy here for months. And so emotions are a very important experience that human beings have. And we have it's become increasingly popular, I think, to focus on emotions here in the West. It's interesting that Paul Ekman, who is a very nowadays famous scientist of emotions, studies emotions, he said that he considers Charles Darwin to have been the founder of modern psychology. And other people, sometimes William James is considered the father. But before William James was publishing, Charles Darwin published a book on emotions. And so he was a biologist studying also the emotional expressions and experiences of humans. And it's very interesting that Darwin should be doing it, because Darwin represents then kind of a wonderful meeting of or intersection of biology, if you will, and psychology. And it seems very appropriate that the founder of modern psychology should be someone so deeply grounded and mostly identified with biology or evolutionary biology. Because emotions are very deeply connected to our physiology, to our biology. And so to only study emotions as pure psyche, as pure mental phenomena, misses a huge part of what emotions are. So, and then in more recent times, we have books like Emotional Intelligence, which became a bestseller. And it seems that, I don't know when, but seems like sometime in the last 40 years or so, 50 years, a lot of people in our psychological West have gotten increasingly interested in emotions and the role that emotions have in our lives and the way in which our emotions, the role that emotions have for our well-being or for our ill-being, for our happiness or our distress. And so there have been a lot of studies about, you know, what are emotions and how they work. They're all very interesting. And one of the most interesting parts of it is that emotions are composites. They're composite events. It's not unitary events, single thing, you know, an emotion. But rather, there's many different mental processes or psychophysical processes that come into play to work together to create what we call an emotion. So that the name emotion, being kind of a, you know, a noun in itself, suggests a thing. But in fact, the word emotion is a category, it's not a thing. And it's a category that we use to define the interactive, a series of interactive processes that make up anger, or make up happiness, or make up fear, or make up confidence, or different things. So it's possible to tease apart these composite elements of what we call emotions. And in this regard, I think it's interesting that even the word emotion should be held lightly, Even though some people are ready to kill over their beliefs around how much or how little you should express your emotions. There's often very strong opinions that people have about their emotions and what should and shouldn't be happening with emotions. But the word emotion is a relatively vague category. And it's interesting that in certain languages, there's no obvious word to translate the English word emotion. And if you look at ancient Buddhist languages, the languages of the Buddha, scholars have a hard time translating the word emotion back into his language. Like if you wanted to go ask the Buddha, hey, what do you do with your emotions? You know, what do you say? What word do you use? And there might be some words that kind of can more or less fit the bill, but the point being that that category isn't the common category. It doesn't mean that in the time of the Buddha, people didn't have anger or happiness or sadness or joy or things we call emotions. But somehow they weren't kind of organized under this idea of emotions. And the reason why I belabor this point is that often emotions are held in the West as a category that's distinct from cognition, distinct from thinking, or distinct from rationality. And in the ancient world, and probably in the modern world as well, there's not a sharp divide between these different faculties within the human beings, between thinking and beliefs and emotions that we might have. So to understand emotions, we have to kind of look more deeply at the different processes that are operating. There's also a lot of so one of the interesting things is to study the effects of emotions. And emotions have a big effect on human life, and they have a big effect on not only our happiness or our sadness or difficulty in life, but also has a big effect on the choices we make. Based on how we're feeling, we might choose different options out of what's available to us. So if you're feeling grumpy, you might make a different choice about how you greet someone coming to your door than if you're feeling relaxed and happy. Emotions affect how we see the world, our experience of the world. It sets a mood, it sets a filter about how we see things. And it also sets a filter over how we might then choose to react and respond to what we see. And then there's a feedback loop, because how we see the world and how we act in response to the world then feeds back again on how we feel about the world. And then how we feel about the world then affects how we see it again. And so there's this wonderful loop that goes around and around. And sometimes that loop ties itself into a nice, tight little ball, knot, and then we feel stuck. And we don't know why we're so stuck, why we're just kind of constantly, you know, feeling resentful or irritable or constantly feeling, sad or something. Because we haven't seen how this kind of looping system works and how we get kind of stuck and caught in it. Emotions, one of the important, seemingly one of the more very important functions of emotions. Why do people have emotions? Why do humans have emotions? And just because it's, you know, to torture us, you know, or just to please us, the good ones are there. It seems that you can make a fairly good evolutionary argument for emotions, in that emotions are motivating. They have an effect. In and of themselves, they affect us. Partly, emotions are deeply embedded in our physiology, in our body. If you didn't have a physical response or reaction to an emotion or expression of emotion, you probably wouldn't know that you're having an emotion. So we get, you know, hot under the collar, or we get butterflies in our stomach, or we get knots in our stomach. A variety of places where the emotions kind of manifest, hot in the face, clenching jaws, a variety of things. And so our musculature in our body gets mobilized. A lot of the physiology gets mobilized when we have an emotional response. So it's interesting that when it seems that, at least I've read this, I haven't noticed it, but I've read that when people get angry, there's a blood flows into the hands. When they get afraid, blood flows into the legs. So one explanation for that is when you're angry, you want to defend yourself with your hands. You create a fist and you want to punch the guy out. When you're afraid, you want to be ready to run. And so you need to have a lot of blood in your legs. So emotions mobilize the body so that we can respond appropriately to what's happening around us. Some emotions narrow the focus of attention. And so we're very hyper-focused on particular details of what's happening. Some emotions tend to relax us and create a kind of a wide, open focus. You see the kind of big picture. So if there's fear, for example, sometimes we'll narrow the focus. And we don't see the big picture so well. We just see what is the most important to be safe. And so if you're out in the woods and you've been told there's a mountain lion, and you hear rustling in the bushes, and then you hear a roar, your attention is going to get very narrow. And you're going to kind of be hyper-attentive looking for where that mountain lion might be. And you're probably not going to be looking at the turkey vultures or something, you know, up in the sky. That doesn't occur to you. So some emotions kind of narrow our attention, and some emotions expand the attention and make it very broad. And in certain situations, it's appropriate to have our attention, the lens of attention, change depending on what's called for and needed in that different situation. So emotions mobilize us to respond and act in different ways. Emotions also, in addition to mobilizing our kind of muscles and our attention, it also causes us to behave in certain ways. So if you get embarrassed, embarrassment generally has a tendency to get us to kind of stop doing what we were doing, kind of be quiet and shut down and kind of... And there are some certain situations perhaps where the best thing you could do is to get embarrassed. Or not embarrassed necessarily, but the effect that embarrassment has. Sometimes it's useful socially to show other people that you're embarrassed, that your face gets all red, and it shows them that you're stopping what you're doing, you're pulling back, and you're somehow maybe not 100% behind what you just did. And maybe that's useful for people to see, you know, as opposed to you kind of great confidence of barreling ahead and doing what you were doing before. So, embarrassment, you know, when you're embarrassed, you act differently than when you're confident. And so emotions affect how we act. Now, what's interesting is that the emotional response, the first moments of the emotional response are often automatic. They're not necessarily thought out. It's not like sitting, driving your car in the freeway and someone suddenly kind of cuts you off in traffic and you think, maybe that wasn't so safe. I think a good response here would be to be angry. the anger somehow seems, for most part, can seem very automatic, very quick. It's more like we become aware that we're angry. We can become aware of the rush of anger happening. But the actual moment of starting the anger, we don't see. Or fear. Fear can seem almost instantaneous in different situations. And it's not necessarily thought out or conscious that, this is a good place. If I'm going to be afraid, now's the time. that might be a thought process occasionally, but generally when people get afraid, people don't necessarily see the beginning of the fear, just very fast. And so there's something automatic about many emotional responses, or seemingly automatic. And what that means is that the first moments of an emotional response is somewhat unconscious or semi-conscious. It's not happening within the field of conscious awareness, which is very interesting for people who want to do mindfulness practice, which is the practice of being conscious of what's going on within us and what happens to us. So if the big part of emotions is automatic and semi or subconscious, then who's in charge? And what are the different conditions? What are the different processes that are operating within us that allow us to have the particular emotional response that we have? So there are certain emotions which are triggered by specific events. Someone cuts you off in traffic, you might get afraid or you might get angry. And that might last for a little while and then dissipates. The event changes, you get off the freeway and you forget about the traffic and those particular feelings go away, which is momentary. But there are some emotions which persist over a long period of time. And maybe we call those in English moods. Moods are that which kind of just lingers. So it's not particularly, we don't associate it with a particular event, but we wake up on the wrong side of the bed, we say. And so we're just kind of irritable all day. It's just an irritable mood. You might win the California lottery, but you still stay irritable. Or maybe get more irritated. And or you're just kind of sad. You're not quite sure why you feel sad, but you seem sad all the time. Or perhaps for some reason you can't fathom you're in a really good mood. What was that about? And so sometimes emotions have this lingering effect where it becomes a mood, and a mood in particular is understood to have a big effect on coloring how we see things, like putting on colored glasses. And we tend to see our experience through the filter of that mood. We tend to see the experience through we tend to make choices through the filter of that mood, unless we're conscious of the effect the mood has on us, so we can make different kind of choices. The interesting thing about moods is moods can be triggered by strong emotional reactions. It's a very powerful emotional response to some event can create a lingering momentum, lingering kind of mood that sets in motion for a long time. From the Buddhist analysis, it's not just a matter that emotion lingers for a long time, but to some degree it's also a matter that we're constantly renewing the emotion, recreating the emotion. So if you find yourself a lingering mood of resentment, it isn't that you just kind of started the resentment really good, powerful, bang, you know, resentment one moment and then just kind of stayed, but rather somehow that resentment's being renewed maybe 100 times in the course of the day, but we don't see how subtle the thinking is or the activity is in the mind to see how that mood is being renewed over and over again. But then to make it all a little more complicated, it seems that certain moods are also the results of our physiology. And so it seems that neuropsychology, neurobiology, the way certain hormones work in their bodies or certain chemicals work, affects our mood. And so they lingers for a long time. And, some people, like testosterone can affect a young man's mood up until a point, and then it changes. And so some people have something now that the research, like on depression, a good number of percentage of people who are chronically depressed, turns out there's maybe a serotonin problem or something, or that's a problem necessarily, but something going on chemically in their physiology. And I've known people who have struggled with depression for years and years. I remember one person who was an amazingly diligent Buddhist practitioner. He became a Buddhist monk, was in the monasteries, did lots of retreats, practiced really, really hard. Whatever his teachers told him, he would try really well. He was a model practitioner. And he never stopped being depressed. Until about, I think it was mid-1980s, they came out with Prozac then. And he said, wow, I didn't need Buddhism. I just needed Prozac. And it, so it, because it wasn't a psychological or spiritual issue, it was a physiological one in his particular case. So sometimes moods, who knows where the source of the mood is. But then even when there's a physiological source for the mood, also we have to be aware that how we react, how we think, what we believe, and how we respond to the world around us has a powerful effect on our physiology as well. Not that some of these physiological effects is our responsibility, but sometimes, maybe I'll say carefully, say occasionally, how you act, how you live, how you respond, how you speak, how you do different things, loops back onto our physiology. And so, for example, if I am really busy and trying to get a lot accomplished because I have a long to-do list, it's really important to finish that to-do list. I'm going to really bore down and just stay present, do, and get, and override my tiredness, override my hunger, override everything. And then one possibility is that I end up being very tense. My shoulders go up to my ears and I'm just kind of all wired up. And then when I finally stop my doing, I wonder, well, why am I feeling so odd? I'll try to shake it out. But it doesn't shake out so well because it's built up. Maybe stress hormones in the body, physical tension in the body, and that might persist for a long time until it kind of works itself out, unless I renew it. And so we know that there are certain occasional illnesses that people have, physical illnesses, that seem to arise because some people are in chronically stressed modes. They're always stressed. And so somehow their system, their ways of thinking, the way of doing in the world, they're always on the edges. And that is a consequence to always be stressed that then affects our physiology and can cause illnesses sometimes. So when we look at emotions, we have to look then very deep, look at this wonderful interplay between emotions and our body. But not just our body, but also our thinking and our beliefs. The stories we tell. It's possible to sit minding your own business, having a good time, being happy, contented, peaceful, and then have some car drive by Hopkins Street here that sounds just like that kind of noisy car that that belonged to that guy who stole your boyfriend or girlfriend in high school. And how could that guy have done that? And, I was really wronged. And the story of, 10, 20, 30 years ago comes back. And clearly the story is a cognitive thing. It's a story. It's an idea. It's words in the mind. It's images in the mind that come back. But as those images and stories come back, you can feel your physiology changing. You can feel the heat and the tension and the anger arise, there. And it's very clear that the anger that arose had genesis in thinking. It wasn't that someone directly in front of you did something that stimulated the anger, but rather some ancient story, memory, arose, and that memory triggered the emotional response. So then we have to ask, what is the relationship between our thinking, our beliefs, our memories, and the emotions that we have? And there can be a very deep connection. And the connection between our thinking is layered. There's different layers of our thinking that affects what we feel. One of the layers has to do with who we think we are. What we think it means to be a human being, to be a person. So if I think that what it is to be a human person is someone who is supposed to be respected by other people, so that when I go into a store, the right thing to people to do is to offer me respect by stop what they're doing and ask me, can I help you? If I go into a store and I'm ignored, the belief of what I expect is operating way back in the background, or not in back, way background, but it's operating there kind of subconsciously perhaps. And so then I'm primed to feel disrespected if I'm ignored. I could go in without that belief, and in different countries I've been to, shopkeepers have different beliefs about how to treat customers. And so, depending on the country I go to shopping in, I'll expect a different response from the shopkeeper. And so there's a little cognitive kind of evaluation that's here in the background that's operating about what to expect. And what I expect affects how I emotionally respond to what's going on. And so I don't know if that was a good example, but our beliefs about who we are and what it is to be human being, what it is to be in relationship to other human being, is also a shifting ground. It changes and shifts over days and months, years and decades. Society changes, and what we think is acceptable behavior. And so so if you start looking also at what do we believe, and how do what we believe affect what we feel, and how would our response are. We might be afraid, if we have a certain belief about what's important, or we might not be afraid in the same situation if we have a different set of belief systems. So what might be a good example? I might be late for a very important date. And I might be anxious about something as simple as the traffic on 101. I'm not going to get there on time. And I get out there and I'm really concerned about the traffic, and in fact it's slowed down, and then they're doing road work. Not only am I afraid, but then I get angry. How could they do road work? You know, when it's just important time. 101 is an important thoroughfare. It's important for commerce, and I need to get to my place. And then, because I'm sitting there stuck, not going to the cars, the traffic's not moving at all, and I just have all this time, I realize I'm going to be here for a while, I pull out my date book, and I look, oh, actually, I left 2 hours early. I have 2 whole hours to get that down to my appointment. And suddenly, I don't feel so frustrated or so afraid anymore, because the consequences of being late, or the consequences of being slow in the freeway, is not so big. So it isn't just simply the traffic and the slow traffic and the Caltrans doing their work, which is the upsetting thing. It has a big part to do with what I believe and what is important for me and what my agenda is. And so the agenda affects the reaction that I have. So this gets very, very subtle. Subtle meaning part of the kind of deep subconscious operating system of our mind. We don't necessarily know all the different beliefs that we're operating on at any given moment. There's layers and layers and different, kind of ideas that we have. And so it's very hard then to see why we react the way we react, why we feel the way that we feel. And I think there's a fair number of people who are mystified by their emotional reactions, especially when their emotional reactions become a mood and they last for a long time. And then they read Buddhist texts that tell you you're supposed to let go. Well, gee, thanks. let go of what? I don't even see what I'm doing here. And I think it's very important to be very respectful of the complexity of the psychophysical kind of world that emotions operated within. So then this points back to then mindfulness. Mindfulness, part of the function of mindfulness is to make experience conscious, to become much more consciously aware of what's happening for us. And as we train ourselves to become more mindful, we start becoming aware of more of the subtlety of what's happening. We see more the greater range of what's happening in our response, in our reactions, in our beliefs, and all these things that are going on. And we can start learning what was subconscious becomes conscious. Maybe what's unconscious never becomes conscious, but there's a whole realm of stuff which is kind of subconscious, kind of just under the surface, that could be conscious if we trained ourselves to notice it, become aware of it, or if we had a heightened sensitivity to what's going on. To give you an example, which may, hopefully it's a suitable example. After I had been doing Buddhist practice for a few years, and I was still a young man, I found myself occasionally falling in love with some woman that I met. So after a while, I got interest in this phenomenon, falling in love. And, you know, it just happens, right? It's chemistry. Just boom, there it is. And I'm not in control. So this is really curious. So I started paying very careful attention with the idea that there must be a choice, a moment of choice. Where is that moment of choice? And so I would look for opportunities to fall in love. Opportunities where that kind of reaction was happening. And for a while, I couldn't see anything. But then at some point I said, oh, look at that. There's a moment of choice. I'm choosing, there's an experience of pleasure, of a delight, of appreciation, of something nice. And there's that moment of going towards it, of wanting more of that. It's a moment of choice where I turn towards and there's desire as part of it. And I thought, wow, there was a choice there. I didn't know I had a choice. And in fact, if you don't know you have a choice, you don't have a choice. And if you don't have a choice, then you're not in control. When you see the place of choice, then you have choice. And then how you act in the world is not, you're not just an automatic pilot. So part of mindfulness then is to start looking carefully, stopping and being very attentive to what's happening so that we can see the fuller range of the experience, what makes up and builds up to the experience. So when there is an emotional reaction, mindfulness helps us to catch it earlier, so we notice it earlier. And so we notice that now that I have an emotional reaction, there's a whole series of choices I can make in the wake of having that emotional reaction. I can punch the guy out. That's one choice. I could, go and get that cheesecake and stuff myself. That's another choice. Or I could choose not to do anything. Or I could change my response. Rather than punching someone out, I can say, you know, I can go over to the person and say, you know, I'm having a little bit of difficulty here. I wonder if it's possible for us to go out and have coffee and talk about this a little bit. And so, we use our mindfulness to see where we have choice in reaction, in relationship to our emotions. This is very important because, as I tried to say earlier, emotions are not just simply sensations and feelings that bubble up. Emotions, I think, have a very close connection to action, to responding, to communicating something. And so to allow ourselves to act on the emotion will sometimes let us act in ways which are not appropriate in the situation. So we can become aware of emotions and having more choice, then we can choose what's appropriate in the situation rather than what the emotional reaction is. And then it's also possible to use mindfulness to look back further and look at the genesis or the conditions that were in place before there was an emotional reaction. The beliefs, the feelings, the mood, the thinking, the stories we tell ourselves that are operating kind of even before we got onto the freeway. And you can notice, oh, I feel like I'm late for an important date, and I'm getting in my car, I'm going on 101, which has a certain notorious for the traffic sometimes at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I bet that given that I'm late, given how important my date is, given where I'm driving, and given that I'm almost out of gas, and given that I've been stressed out all day, I bet that all those things are prime conditions for me to get irritated on the freeway. I bet that's the case. That's a good bet. So I don't really want to get irritated. So I think that I better use my mindfulness and breathe deeply and try to be very attentive when I get on the freeway to watch what my reactions are so I don't get swept away by them and caught by them. So as we do meditation practice, in addition to mindfulness practice, meditation practice also begins stilling the mind, quieting the mind down. And as the mind gets quieter and stiller and stiller, we start seeing the subtle operating thoughts and beliefs that are there kind of in the subconscious. And subtle does not mean inconsequential. Sometimes it's that which is in the lower levels of subconscious, least accessible, very subtle, very quiet, which are the big messages, which are the big kind of stage directors of our life, the big messages that we have. And sometimes it's very hard to see the stories, the beliefs, the memories that are most operating, most impactful for different situations, because they're so subtle. And they're so subtle that the normal discursive thinking will mask it. Normal discursive thinking won't show it. And so we have to stop the ordinary discursive thinking so we can see the subtler thinking that's kind of the fuel for our reactions, responses to what's going on. So one of the many functions of meditation is to quiet that discursive thinking down so we can listen to something that's much, much quieter, shyer, much kind of more subtle, that's very meaningful in creating the conditions that prompt the almost automatic response of emotions that we might have. And then we understand this fundamental, the deeper conditioning, the deeper kind of stories and beliefs and ideas, then it's possible to question them, and it's possible to replace them with ideas and understanding beliefs that are more accurate or more useful for us. So we also take responsibility for the operating system for which, you know, our reactions and responses to the world are about. So that's my introduction. On the Mondays that I come, I will pick up individual emotions. And if you have a particular one that is not obvious, you can always, you know, make a request. But I'll go through for a while until it feels like we've done enough on emotions, or I've done enough. And then we'll go on to something else. Does that seem okay? So we have 5 minutes before the end. Does anyone want to bring something up at this point, this juncture in our emotion series? Yes, please.
You mentioned that sometimes it seems like the emotions are just triggered instantly, or they're not triggered consciously by rational thought. And I know in one of the books I've read, which I think was a book with the Dalai Lama and Daniel Goleman and some other people, there was a debate as to if you got a high enough level of practice in meditation, whether or not you could see that moment of cognition and that trigger. What are your thoughts on that, and does the Vipassana or Theravada tradition have a different answer for that?
So the question is it possible to see what? See?
Is it possible to see when the emotion's being triggered?
The moment of emotional...
Yeah.
I believe the answer is yes, if the mind if the mindfulness and concentration is really strong. And generally, in my experience, that's true. In retreats, in meditation retreats. And on meditation retreats, the mind is kind of so sharp and so strong and so mindful and so still that there are periods of time where every single emotional response seemingly is seen at its moment of being born. But that doesn't mean that I necessarily understand everything behind it that goes into it, but I can see the moment that it seems to be triggered and caused. And I remember the first time that I saw this when I was in Burma in the monastery there, I was kind of in awe to see the chain, the individual moments of the chain of reactivity that led to my emotional response. So wow, you can really kind of track a lot. I don't think that I could do that in my ordinary everyday life, see everything. Because things happen so fast, my mind isn't that subtle and that still, you know, there's so much going on. So I'm pretty confident that if suddenly, you know, this mountain lion jumped into this room here, that I wouldn't actually be tracking the first moment of fear. You know, I would be well on the way, you know, being afraid before I had some presence of mind to notice, oh, I'm afraid. So mindfulness. But it's very interesting because, you know, what triggers? There's an very interesting thing that can happen in strong meditation, strong meditative stillness, that that ordinary thinking can come almost to a stop. So there's very little thinking going on. And so it's maybe a long period the mind seemingly has no thought at all. But you're very attentive, and then you can feel, some people report it this way, and this is how I felt it. It's like a bubble of pressure, like a little bubble of pressure, kind of beginning to rise up in the mind. And recognition, there's a recognition, oh, this is a thought coming. So you see a thought's about to be born. A little bubble, a little pressure or something. And you're right there and you notice it, because you really notice, oh, it dissolves. And you'll never know what that thought was going to be. You'll never know what that thought was going to be. Maybe it was going to be the great American novel, it's going to be the answer to all of life's questions. You'll never know. But what it points to is that our thinking itself might have its beginning in subconscious or unconscious realms. And so we can't get back there sometimes to the, even with the beginning of where, you know, where a thought, or we might see it when it rises and gets born, but the beginning of a thought doesn't happen intentionally or out of choice. So there's a whole realm in which our psychological life doesn't belong to the self. The self, when we have the idea the self is the one who's in control and choosing and, you know, responding and all that, it's something kind of impersonal or selfless involved in the birth of something like a thought. So what does that say? Okay, one more and then we'll stop.
I wonder if not tonight, but if you might address sometime the distinction between seeking and trying to slow down, notice the trigger, versus having the emotion, just let it pass through you, so that, you know, it moves very quickly. What I'm thinking of is a friend of mine who's a Chinese face reader for like 35 years and has studied the Dalai Lama quite a bit, and she says in noticing that she thinks he has all these emotions, but he just never gets attached to any of them, that they just flow right through rather quickly. I know sometimes we get kind of, I feel sometimes I get hung up trying to figure out what the trigger is so much that I don't pay any attention to, well, if it's here, now what do you do with it?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so the difference between understanding its genesis, what triggered it, versus understanding how we relate to it once it comes. And both are important. In mindfulness practice, we tend not to do a lot of analysis of thinking back, reflecting back at what the causes are. That can be an important thing to do, but we tend to try to be very mindful of what is. And so if what is our relationship to an arisen emotion, and we become aware of our resistance to it or holding on to it or whatever it might be. And as we become wiser about how we relate to it, then we can relate more wisely. We can choose to be and leave it alone and just let it move through us very freely. As we do this very careful work of being mindful and present for experience, then with time we also start seeing earlier and earlier, we start seeing the conditions before even the arising. We start becoming cognizant of much more what's going on. And so then we could also become aware more of the triggers as well in present moment time. So, does this seem interesting to you? Interesting enough? Some of you have some emotions, so, you know, somewhat relevant to some of you. So those of you who have the emotions occasionally could come, and those of you who don't have any emotions and are happily oblivious of your emotional life, you should come too. So thank you all.